Welcome, members and guests, to the July 10th program of the City, or July 17th program of the City, of the City Club of Eugene, 2015 Legislative Wrap. Thank you for joining me. I am James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are Network Charter School, a standards-based, hands-on public school for students grades 7 to 12, Marilyn Milne of Public Relations Services, and Dot Dotson's Photography. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 p.m. on Monday nights and for archiving these podcasts on their site. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 43rd program in our 2014-2015 programming year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's program, 2015 Legislative Wrap, is coordinated by John Belcher and Marty Wilde. John Belcher will be introducing today's program and the speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, James. The legislature has tackled some big issues in this session, passing bills to mandate paid sick leave, allowing for a prescription of a year's worth of birth control, mandating clean fuels, requiring background checks and gun purchasing, registering voters automatically upon the issuance of a driver's license, and providing an opt-out retirement system for workers not enrolled in a retirement savings plan, to name a few. Critics fault the legislature for failing to address tax reform, PERS underfunding, and for prolonging the underfunding of the K-12 budget. Who won and who lost in this legislative session? We are very fortunate to hear from senior members of our local legislature delegation about these issues and what will happen between this section and next session and next, and we've also asked Commissioner Bosevich provide his perspective on how the legislature impacted local governments with their actions or inactions, and in particular Lane County. So what I'm going to do is ask these folks to come to the table, to the dais up here, and I will introduce them as they're coming up. Senator Lee Beyer is a District 6 state senator since 2010. He's the chairman of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and a member of the Senate Rules, Education, and Measure 91 Implementation Committees. He represented House District 42 from 1991 to 1998, and he was a Springfield City Councilor from 1986 to 1993. And in between, he served 9 years on the Oregon Public Utility Commission. He has worked professionally in business and industrial development and on numerous boards and committees. Senator Beyer and his spouse, former State Representative Terry Beyer, have 3 grown children and have lived in Springfield for 50 years. Val Hoyle has served as a state representative representing West Eugene, Junction City, and Cheshire since 2009, and up until a little while from now has served as majority leader for the Oregon House since 2012. Under Val's leadership, Democrats in Oregon passed the largest K-12 budget in the state's history and helped small businesses have the tools they need to expand. Val has more than 25 years of private sector business experience in domestic and international sales, wholesale distribution, and retail management in the sporting goods industry. She's a founding member of the Eugene Chamber of Commerce's International Trade Roundtable. She's represented District 14, encompassing West Eugene, et cetera, since 2009. She received her Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science from Emmanuel College in Boston, Massachusetts. She lives in West Eugene with her husband, Stephen, and their 2 dogs. Val's 2 children attend college in Oregon. Jay Bosevich was born in Washington, D.C., the son of a CBS news correspondent. He earned a degree in engineering in 1981 from the University of Maryland. He obtained his license as a professional engineer in 1987. He was a senior engineer in the water division of EWEB, where he was elected when he was elected as a county commissioner. He's a founding board member of the River Road Santa Clara Volunteer Library. Thank you for that, Jay. He was elected to the Lane County Board of Commissioners in 2010 and is the current chair. So, without further ado, I'll get out of the way and let you listen to the people you want to hear, starting with Senator Beyer.
Thank you, John. If you can't hear me well, let me know. I've got a bit of a cold, sort of an aftermath of the legislative session. Seven minutes, that's what we have, so I'm going to just kind of run really fast here. One of the things I'd start out with telling you is that this is my 10th session that I've participated in, and it always tickles me a little bit to see the reaction of outsiders and all that to that, and you know, whether it's a good session, bad session, this or that. It depends on your perspective. I will tell you that from my perspective, it was pretty much a routine session. It wasn't an extraordinary session, but it was a pretty routine session, and I think it was fairly bipartisan as we went through it, although I think you'd hear different perspectives on that. Overall, this time, there were 2,791 bills that were introduced in the legislature, about half of those, a little more than half of them from the House, the other portion from the Senate. We ended up passing 684 bills, again, about routine. One of the things I hear a lot, inside the chambers, it's always the other side is killing my bills. I went back and looked at that and actually found out that the House actually killed more of the Senate's bills that they passed than the Senate the others, although you'll never convince a representative of that. I looked at the bills that we passed in general and it's like 96% of all the bills that passed the Senate were passed on a totally bipartisan basis. 74% of them had at least 27 out of the 30 votes to them. 54% of them were unanimous. So that gives you a sense that it really did. Most of the action really was that. Now, in fairness to say, people ran their campaigns with a few issues in mind, an agenda. Those always turn out to be partisan votes at the end of the day. That's just the way the process works. And I thought a lot about that. And I guess if you think about that, from the people who won their election, they will say, I ran on this. I'm delivering to my constituency. And that was true. So that was kind of that session. So what did we get done? Well, the big issues for me when I started was I wanted to pass a retirement program for those who don't have an access to one. I was here before and talked about that. I won't go into great detail unless you want on that. We got that done. That program will be implemented in 2016. We have the process in place. We extended the low carbon fuel standard that originally passed in 2009. That was a bit of a political issue. And unfortunately, we didn't get a transportation funding package done. Some of the things that we spent a lot of time on was education. In 2013 session, we made the largest new addition to education in Oregon's history. We put in over $1 billion into the K-12 system. This time, we added $700 million in addition to that. So it's a lot. That's the good news. The bad news is it's not enough. We still need to do more, although we did fund K-12, and although I think all of us, one of the things that I noticed this time is that our school superintendents got very active. We got numerous letters from them all the time telling how things was. And then at the end, they all seemed to say that things had worked out pretty well. On the higher ed front, we added for the first time in many, many sessions $700 million to the university system and $550 million more to the community college system. Hopefully that will encourage them not to raise tuition as much. We have a budget note suggesting that. In terms of building projects for the University of Oregon, we continued the trend of supporting their building things. We added funding for Klamath Hall, which is the chemistry building on the campus. That gets an extra, I think it's an extra floor and renovation in that. We funded the new career building. It's the liberal arts and sciences. Doesn't have a real home now. They're going to build a new building for that, a $20 million project. One of the nice pieces to that, I believe, is that we'll house on the first floor the career counseling and the place for interviews for private employers coming in. So all the kids starting out their career will have to go through that, and they'll have that orientation, and I think that's really good. and then finally, we finally funded Chapman Hall, which is one of the older buildings on the campus. It houses the Honors College presently, and it's an interesting three-story building if you include the daylight basement, and Jerry probably knows more about it than I do, but yeah, I don't think you can get from one floor to the other currently without going outside and heard tales about the electrical system and the plumbing system and the HVAC system. There's nothing right about that building other than it looks really cool. Other issue that I spent too much time on was implementing Measure 91, the marijuana initiative that passed. We spent, if you can envision that, every Monday and Wednesday evening from 5 to 7:30 or 8, working with trying to implement that bill and working it all out. And it was an interesting thing, one of the more interesting in my career. If you looked at the audience, we started out with one of the biggest hearing rooms in the Capitol, and then we were backed up by a second hearing room because we had overflow crowds, and you had everything in the audience every time. I mean, they're very good at coming to every meeting, from 60s hippies to out-of-town three-piece suitors in there. It's amazing the interest that 91 has generated across the board. I think we put some protections in place. For me, what was important were two things. One was, to the extent we could, trying to keep it out of the hands of kids. That won't completely be possible, but try to do as best as we can. I think we did that. And the other one was, to the extent we can, set a structure in place of regulation and fees that would get the black market out. So we'll see how we're going to do with that one. Pretty good. Other things we did is we took Cover Oregon. A lot of controversy when we went into the session on that. As you may recall, it was an out-of-state, or it was an out-of-government private entity. The way it was created, we brought it in-house, cracked some of the administration in that. I think that program is running well now, although we're still litigating it. We passed a ban the box issue, dealing with people to give those who have served their time for a prior offense a better chance at least having a chance to get a job, full-year birth control. And I'm going to stop. I'm getting the orange card here, so I'll look forward to your questions.
Hi, thank you for having me here again. It's really nice to be back home. Spending a long time in Salem, you know, it's always nice to be able to be back in Eugene. I think I just want to build on something that my colleague, the good senator, said in terms of the House killing more of the Senate's bills. It's just that we had better bills. I can't help that. But we did have an impressive string of accomplishments. Now, as the majority leader, my job was to manage the floor. So working with, 34 Democrats. Someone asked me, is that like herding cats? I'm like, it's more like herding flies. Democrats are, they're an independent lot. But also working with the Republican caucus leader and his caucus to ensure that we managed the floor well, and when we disagreed, we didn't do so in a way that blew up the process. And that was actually vitally important. So we were able to have our say, but again, ensure that things didn't melt down. So the things that we did, and again, Senator Beyer listed many of them, but we're the first state in the nation with an automatic voter registration law. So that's 300,000 extra people that will automatically be registered when they get a driver's license through the DMV. Now, I think that we've had a lot of voter registration efforts, and they tend to be in the more urban, more liberal, more college and university areas. This is something that will happen statewide. We're also able to put money in place so that the county clerks who said, this is going to cost us extra money, this is a burden, we were able to put the money in that they asked for to ensure that that's also paid for, so it's not an unfunded mandate. We enacted universal paid sick time for all workers, which was really important and something that was important here in Eugene. But I believe that employment law is better when it's not done in a patchwork. So this is something that is statewide. So I talked with a number of businesses, and one of them said, look, whatever is going to happen is going to happen, and we may agree or disagree, but I don't want to be at a disadvantage to my competitor in Roseburg or my competitor who's in Clackamas County. So having something statewide was important. And for the workers, that is an incredibly important and valuable law. We established universal background checks on gun sales. Now, I'll tell you, coming from my district is not the most liberal district. My district supports the idea of background checks. They also support the Second Amendment and ensuring that they can go hunting, they can go fishing, and they can have firearms, and I think that's fine. But I think having background checks and closing that loophole was important. Most of you know that somebody threatened to recall me and tried to do that. Last week, we found out that that wasn't successful. Neither were two other recall attempts in the Portland metro area. We just have Floyd Przanski, who there's an outstanding recall effort in place, but I'm hopeful that that won't go through either. I'm very, very happy to have taken that vote, and I think it's important. And I'm also glad that the recall didn't go through. But again, I want to reach out to the people here in this room that said, you know, again, on both sides of the aisle, if you end up in a recall election, we will be there for you. And because of that, that meant that I was able to step up and vote for something that, again, I think is very important. We increased K-12 funding and made universal all-day kindergarten a reality statewide. You know, Betty Roberts, when she was in the legislature so many years ago, fought for full-day kindergarten, and now it is a reality so that we can make sure that every child starts first grade ready to learn. That's tremendous. Reclassified most major birth control as over-the-counter medication and made it so that women can get a 12-month supply of birth control. That just makes it easier, especially in rural areas. It's less expensive, and it's vitally important. Ban the box on job applications so that we can ensure that people that are coming out of our prison system at least have a chance to get their foot in the door. That's important. I think we passed the Clean Fuels Bill, and that ended up being controversial. But again, if you believe, as I do, that climate change is one of the greatest threats that's facing us today, we couldn't not do something. We couldn't not do something. So passing clean fuels was something we ran on, was something we passed, and that has a goal of decreasing carbon from oil and other fuels outputs for in the next 10 years by 10%. Now, there were other bills that would have done more. I think Tom Bowerman's here. We had House Bill 3470, and we were able to move it to Ways and Means. There wasn't support to get it on to go further, but that would look at all sectors and also the impact on the workforce. We had the one of the ministers from Quebec come down and say, look at what we've done in Canada in terms of addressing carbon and actually making there be a market incentive to lower your carbon output. And what they've seen is tremendous increase in jobs and investment. And that's critical. I'm hopeful that next session we can come back and go further. But those are just some of the things. We also had over almost a billion dollars in bonding. And the things that we're going to see here are $300 million to improve school facilities. In my district in Junction City, both schools are 100% likely to come down in an earthquake. 100% likely. So we have $175 million for seismic upgrades in schools and $300 million total that directly goes to schools. So when you have small communities and rural communities that don't have the tax base, we can ensure that those kids get the protection that they need. We have $90 million in traffic improvements, including $7 million on Oregon on Highway 126 from Eugene to Florence. That's really critical. Really dangerous stretch of road, but we want to make it safer. I think I'm about out of time, and I want to ensure that we give Commissioner Bozovic time to give his perspective, and I'm looking forward to answering your questions.
I want to thank the City Club for inviting me here today and being flexible in how they characterize the discussion today. The Board of Commissioners is a nonpartisan body, and it's a key partner within the structure of the state and the legislature. And I want to reference something that the Association of Oregon County has put together, and it's the Shared Services Chart. And for the radio audience, it's a list of services by various category, like public safety and health and human services. And it's color-coded, red for the shared services, green for the state services, and blue for the county-provided services. If you notice, red dominates this chart. We are key partners with the state in almost every public service that you receive as a citizen. And it's because of these shared services, Lane County plays a significant role during the legislative session. In fact, we have a staff person that practically lives in Salem, which I'm sure these two know Alex very well. And we also go through a process to develop legislative priorities even prior to session and work on having bills drafted prior to session. So probably one of our biggest successes this legislative session came in the Human Services budget bill. And I'd really like to recognize Representative Nancy Nathanson for her work on this. Yeah, we have in Lane County a gap in our juvenile justice system. And it's those kids that are in our foster care system that are in danger of becoming part of the criminal justice system. And what happens a lot of times is these kids are in foster homes and they have a blow up with their foster parents, and there's no place for them to have respite stay in Lane County. They end up being transported out of the county, or they end up on the streets. And I don't know if you guys are aware of what the 15th night initiative is, but if a kid stays on the streets for 15 nights, they're almost 90% likely to become chronically homeless when they're an adult. So this little piece, $250,000 allocation, is allowing Lane County to take an existing building, retrofit it, and set up this respite care facility for these kids here in Lane County. You know, and it was Nancy Nathanson that helped us get that through. And there was also help from both Representative Hoyle and Senator Prozanski on that. So that was a success, kind of a mixed success, might be ensuring that a bill that was originally shepherded by Senator Prozanski, the Justice Reinvestment Program, was fully funded this year. The original budget that the governor put forward was $58 million for that program, which was the full amount of the projected savings in deferred prison cost construction that trying to keep people out of prison was going to save. Unfortunately, the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee only allocated $20 million in their proposed budget. We finally, after a lot of, you know, hard lobbying, which, you know, I even pulled Representative Hoyle off the floor one day to talk to her about this, got that up to $40 million in the last bill, which sounds great, unless you remember that they took $1.3 million and gave it to the Department of Justice for administrative costs, and they wrapped $5 million of local jail funding from House Bill 5008 into the bill, so the net was a lot less, and in fact only about 60% of the projected cost, deferred cost. So it's really sad, because those are programs that keep people out of prison, like sponsors and other programs like that. And probably one of our greatest sadnesses and losses was the transportation bill. I really have to thank Senator Beyer for his hard work as a member of the Gang of Eight. The bill that came out would have been excellent for Lane County. You all, I want to thank the City Club for endorsing our vehicle registration fee, would have raised $6.5 million for Lane County. The transportation bill would have been $6 million a year for Lane County. Plus, it included significant bonding for improvements to Highway 126, Territorial Road, and other projects within Lane County that would have been excellent for us. I'm just sorry that did not pass. It was an opportunity missed. And finally, I'd like to address something about courthouse facility funding. We worked for over a year with a task force with Associated Oregon Counties and Department of Justice to identify the priority projects within this whole state of which courthouses needed fixed and which didn't, which needed bonding, and put forth together a package to the legislature for bonding. Last minute, the package was torn apart by the committee, and the Lane County piece was pulled out of there. That would have allowed us to continue our work scoping and designing a courthouse replacement that helps us make decisions around real estate in downtown Eugene and hopefully find a permanent home for the farmers market here in downtown. Now that's in jeopardy because they chose to ignore the long-term work of a task force and pull that funding out of there. So a couple things were disappointing there. I hope in question and answers I get to talk a little bit about unfunded mandates and a few other bills that passed. We did end up supporting the motor voter bill if it was amended to include funding. We were disappointed the actual bill didn't, but we were happy that Representative Hoyle and Senator Devlin made good on their promises and funded it in the end. It would have been a significant problem for Lane County to come up with the additional funding in our elections department. So I look forward to answering questions, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Today's topic is 2015 legislative wrap. Our speakers are Val Hoyle, former Oregon State House Majority Leader, Oregon State Senator Lee Baer, and Lane County Commissioner Jay Bozovich. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport, 90.5, KLFR Reedsport, 89.1, and at 88.1, KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Welcome back to the July 17th City Club Program 2015 Legislative Wrap. Our guest speakers are Val Hoyle, Lee Baer, and Jay Bozovich. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Thank you so much for a good, quick rundown. I'm Jane Smith, City Club for a number of years. I'm asking this question for a guest at our table. It's an important question. What does the future of House Bill 3420, which had to do with reallocating funds for the Housing First, which is a principle that it's hard to provide services unless you can pin down the person who needs services. So Housing First is an imperative, including wet beds. But the question is, what does that bill look like for the 2016 legislative session?
Thank you. This is Val Hoyle, and thank you for that question. That was my bill, so I'm a little familiar with it. What we did was looked at that bill. So we will do a study, get people together to really think about how can we invest that kind of money. But we also invested $40 million in affordable housing, in bonding authority, in affordable housing across the state, because one of the key things that we know is if people can find a home, if they can find affordable housing, then they can address their other issues. It's really hard to keep a job when you're living in your car. We also put $20 million into supported housing for Oregonians struggling and suffering from severe and persistent mental illness. And that was one of the key things that we wanted with this Housing First bill, is if people are going to treat their disease, they really have to have a home in order to do that. So we actually, we put $40 million in investment in community mental health programs and $20 million specifically for housing of this population that, again, when they have housing, when they have access to community services, it means they don't end up in the state hospital, they don't end up in our emergency rooms, and most importantly, they don't end up in our prisons. So I think Commissioner Bozovich talked about justice reinvestment, and we did put $40 million into community-based programs, but this $20 million is a crossover. I mean, when I talk to law enforcement officials and when I talk to people that work in the justice reinvestment field, what they've said is if people can get treatment for their severe and persistent mental illness, if we treat mental illness in the same way that we treat physical illness, then we will be able to, again, not penalize people just because they're sick. But we were able to put money in there, and again, I believe that a good portion of this investment, an appropriate portion of this investment, will come into Lane County.
And to be clear, that's a total of $60
million. Okay, I'm John Enick, City Club member since 2003. I'm asking this question on behalf of Mike Rose at our table, and this is for all three of you. What do you consider to be the number one issue of unfinished business facing the state legislature? And we also footnote that this would include issues involving infrastructure.
This is Senator Lebyer. Actually, I'm going to give you two rather than one. One is the transportation system. We really are woefully underfunded there, and we need to take that on. The other one is Representative Hoyle was speaking earlier. I think we need to seriously address the climate issues, and we did a little bit of that with clean fuels, but that's just a very small piece of it.
I guess this is Val Hoyle. I would have to agree with Senator Beyer on those issues. Again, ensuring that we can pass a transportation package that will allow us to upgrade our investment in infrastructure, especially seeing as the federal government is not able to get along well enough to come up with a plan. And we need appropriate investment in education, and I don't know how we do that with our current tax and revenue structure, but I think that is critical. And again, as Senator Beyer said, ensuring that we're doing something real about climate change, and that is a difficult conversation to have, but it is something that's critical, and hopefully we'll be able to work on that in the next number of sessions.
So I will have to agree with Senator Beyer that probably the number one unfinished piece of business was a transportation bill, and particularly in light of the New Yorker article and, in fact, the actual report that came out in the 2013 session from the task force on the subduction zone earthquake, the resiliency plan. There's a lot of infrastructure in Oregon that's in desperate need of seismic upgrade, and we are not well prepared like Japan or Chile was for some of their earthquakes, and it will actually impact the entire country's economy if we do have this subduction zone earthquake. So that's probably my number one. Number two would actually be tax reform, and I think there is some necessity to deal with the fact that the ONC counties and the timber-dependent counties were frozen into unrealistically low tax levels, and that some of the compression laws are causing some extreme issues in our ability to fund locally some of the local services versus being subsidized for those services like the state police that are now patrolling Josephine County, and the folks in Portland are actually paying for that. So I think we need to really take a look at our overall tax system and find something that's going to maybe readjust that. Mm-hmm. So I think those are probably my top two unfinished pieces of business.
Hello, my name is Eric DeVriest. I'm a City Club member as of today with Lou Vos Cobb. This question goes towards what you were just speaking of, but other than the transportation bill, or even with the transportation bill, what bills were unsuccessful during the last session? And I wonder if you expect certain bills to be retooled or amended to be represented next session, and how they may best be amended to be successful.
Well, I guess this is Lee Beyer. Obviously, the transportation bill is the top of the mind for me. I chair the Senate Transportation and Business Committee, so that's probably top of the mind. I would like to think we can do something in the 16th session, although the politics around that in an election year make it very tough to get people running for election to vote for tax increase, and that's just a reality. But we're thinking about that. We're a lot of people talking about how to do that. It's an interesting issue in terms of, you know, we started the session, virtually all of the leadership of both parties said this is a top priority. The leadership of labor and business across the state and environmental groups said this is a top priority, and we weren't able to get it done. So that has to be there. The other one is I'm very serious, you know, about dealing with the climate issues. I think we really have to look at that. We've seen some leadership in Canada, in California, and on the East Coast where they've actually taken some fairly significant steps, and it has proven not to be economically devastating to their economies, and actually the reverse has been true. Building up that discussion is important. I like to say it's not important for my generation, it's important for my grandkids. We're the ones, if we don't take action and take care of that, it's our grandchildren that are going to pay the price for it. So that's that. The other one, and I think Jay got to this, is tax reform. We did create a work group and charged our legislative revenue office, which are the professional economists, to take a look at some issues on that and come back with some recommendations for the 16th session. Again, I'd like to be optimistic about that, but I think those kinds of things are very hard to do in an election year.
Thank you. This is Val Hoyle. Governor Brown, she made it her first priority after, I just want to say, we, in the first month of session, lost our governor. And the next day, I was talking to Senator Beyer earlier today, the next day we got up, we went to work, we focused on doing what we had to get done, and, you know, our new governor came in, and the trains kept on the track, and we were able to continue to work towards the outcomes and doing our job. That's actually tremendous. I mean, to think about it, if you look at other states, it would have been pretty easy for everything to implode, but it didn't, and we got things done, but there's still more to do. And the one thing about the February session is not only is it closer to election time, so people are more hesitant about taking tough votes, but there's only 35 days. So you have to have everything set up before you walk in the door. But there are things that we didn't finish. Governor Brown put forward three different bills on ethics reforms, you know, the role of the first spouse, expanding the Ethics Commission and ensuring that, that they respond in a shorter period of time and a number of things. But when we looked at what we were able to do in session, got a bipartisan group of legislators together, we really felt like we needed to take more time. So the speaker is going to appoint a subcommittee of the Rules Committee with a bipartisan, equal Democrat and Republican representation to come forward and look at whether it's campaign finance or ethics or campaign laws. Those were things that we weren't able to get done in the midst of the session, which, although we got a lot done, there was still I think it made it a little bit tougher, and once we're out of the building and we're able to sit down, I think issues around, again, ethics, campaign finance reform, and campaign other campaign laws are critical, and we'll have a proposal in the next February session to move forward.
So this is Jay Bozovich, and I just want to mention two quick things. One is a bill that probably none of you know about. The state was on the verge of passing statewide retail licensing for tobacco and nicotine products for the retail, and it failed last second because of some technical issues relative to budgeting for the FTE and things like that. I believe that'll be an easy pickup in the 2016 short session, and is a really good way of preventing youth smoking, because with that revenue stream, you can do a lot more enforcement of sales to youth and deal with some other issues. I wouldn't mind if they raise the smoking age up to 21 with that bill also, but we'll get there. The second one was a pre-session bill we wrote that never got the hearing about. It was basically a mirror bill to the Justice Reinvestment Act, but it was called the Mental Health Reinvestment Act, where it would take some savings that we could get from intervening early in mental health, keeping people out of jails, out of prison, out of homeless shelters and other services, and putting that into mental health services at the local level. And I would love to see that bill come back up in the short session in 2016.
Greetings, Paul Thompson, a City Club member on and off since 2003. Our table would like to seize upon the opportunity of having you, Senator Beyer, and Representative Hoyle here to get some insight into the actual functioning, the dynamics of getting bills through and so on. And so we wonder whether you would select one of your largest legislative disappointments of the last session and tell us what were the forces that caused it to be defeated, what deals were made, what deals were broken. Give us some insight into the dynamics there.
Well,
I'm trying to remember. Yeah.
The problem is you move forward so fast on them, it's hard to keep them up. I suppose the biggest disappointment for me, and this is Lee Byer, has to be the transportation plan. And I can't point to a particular bill because that's, you know, doesn't the way it works. Frankly, we always assume it's going to happen in the end. And I will tell you that in my committee, there were three different bills that had a relating clause relating to transportation. Then that's important. You can't do a bill that isn't germane. You have to have something there. So I grabbed those very quickly. They were technical bills and set them aside for us to work with. We started meeting in a bicameral bipartisan group in February and started working on a transportation package, and we're going along really, really well. And then the low carbon fuels bill passed and was signed by the governor, and the minority party then just stopped. That was a stopping place. That was a reason not to move forward. So that just killed the discussion until, I guess it was mid-May, and then the governor pulled the leadership back together, and they spent a few days working on it at the Mahoney Hall, which is the governor's residence. Sort of goes back to famous because that's where the workers' comp compromise was worked out in 1990. And then they appointed what became what the newspapers tagged the Gang of Eight, which I was a participant of, to try and come up and do a package there. And the package, the agreement that we started on that one was we had to get the projected carbon reductions that would take place out of the low-carbon fuels as a starting place, come up with a different way to get to the same number before we could then talk about transportation. That was a requirement of the minority party participating. They wouldn't participate without that. From my perspective as someone who was advocating and sponsored the Clean Fuels Bill, my comment was I was agnostic on how we got there. What I want to do is reduce carbon. So we did that, and we came up with, you know, after a lot of discussion, then we probably spent, the eight of us probably spent, you know, 8 or 10 days in the governor's conference room all day long working on that. And then for one reason or another, it broke apart on the House side. Then the Senate continued and put a bill out that would get there. But the end result of that, and I thought it was a really good transportation package, a reasonable package that we put on the table. But in the end, it was just too late in the session to get it done. There was the forecast of the carbon impact changed. The Department of Transportation came in at the last minute of the hearing and said, we misunderstood the directions, and so here's different. Now, I will tell you that at the point the leadership pulled the plug, we still had achieved more carbon reductions than was projected into the low-carbon fuels. And when I say that, everybody debates about all that, but understand, those are all econometric models that are being run that project, you know, how are people going to react to these things, and what are you going to get? So it was unfortunate. We got close, but we didn't get there.
So I think that's an interesting question, and there are certainly from I'm disappointed in the transportation, in us not being able to put forward a transportation bill, but I also being the chamber that we didn't have the votes for the transportation package as it came forward, especially after the head of ODOT came in and said, I'm sorry, those numbers are not quite right by a factor of a lot. But the big thing is that if we're going to invest in transportation, we should invest in transportation and have a public process. And it's impossible to do in 12 days, even though we had some of the best people on transportation at the table. And there are two things that were not connected. But in any case, my biggest disappointment was a small bill that really didn't make the kind of difference that transportation infrastructure would make. But it was one of my colleagues, Representative Brian Clem, voted for the background check bill. But coming from Coos Bay in a rural area, what was important to him was that there was a provision to allow people to loan a gun to a friend and do a background check by phone as opposed to having to go to a gun shop. That was important to him, And we said, if you vote for this, we will get this done. We were able to pass that amendment through the House on a bipartisan basis, but it was at the end of session because there was a lot of negotiating on, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? We got that there, and at that point, the Senate Republicans said that they did not want to pass the bill and that it would blow things up. And at the end of session, it's just really difficult to have something that's going to blow everything up. And I felt bad because, you know, we had Republicans that voted against the background check bill but voted for this because they wanted to support a colleague and they knew they felt this would make it a better bill. We weren't able to translate that those relationships, and that was done on the basis of relationships. And I think that's the key thing in the building is that even though we're in different parties, even though we come from different parts of the state, we actually do work together. And I think, you know, having the kind of process that gets good policy takes time. It went over to the Senate, wasn't able to be get rule suspension on the last few days. And I think even though it's a small thing, it was personally difficult because when you work hard for someone, you want to make sure that you get that done. And we just weren't able to do it.
Joshua Scove, City Club member, going way back to June. So the climate change policy community has globally reached near universal consensus that we need one type of policy instrument before all the others, and that's a price on carbon pollution. It could be a tax, could be via cap and trade, but the consensus is there in order to spur innovation, change behavior, shift investment, et cetera, to create a low-carbon economy. So that's the global policy conversation. This is Oregon. Knowing that this is one of the big issues of the time and in the spirit of several of the previous questions, and also knowing that the environmental community will bring this back, please tell us, what did we learn about the climate politics of Oregon in this past legislative session? And how can we fix them?
That's important.
Well, this is Lee Beyer again. Well, you've seen how hard it was to do a small piece of that, the low carbon fuels piece. I think that at this point, the elected legislators as a total body are not there. The business community is strongly opposed to dealing with the issue because of the perceived economic impact of that, although I just said in a prior comment that other areas have proven that not to be the case. And you've got some big players out there that are really strongly pushing on it. It becomes, unfortunately, a partisan issue. I'm not really sure why, but I think that's a reality. It is a partisan issue that makes it very hard. I'm not sure what to tell you what you can do about that other than those who feel strongly about it, and I hope you all do, is talk to people like Val and I. And I would. This comes across as partisan, and I try not to do that. Particularly, talk to the people in the Republican Party about it, because that seems to be where a lot of the opposition rests on this.
This is Val Hoyle, and I think I would have to agree with Lee that we need to also think about how we present the information. There is a perceived economic downside to having some kind of carbon pricing or market force that helps us get to a different place where we can, you know, reduce the amount of carbon. But actually, if we talk about it in those terms and talk about how many jobs that have been created in other places where they do have these types of programs, then that is actually where we can have people come forward and support it that wouldn't be your traditional supporter. So instead of just talking to ourselves where, you know, you have a lot of people that agree that this is the number one issue, we have to come in and both make the economic argument and then also talk about the reality of what climate change will do and will bring if we don't do something. But the key thing is learning to talk a language that people who don't necessarily think the way you do can understand, and I believe the economic argument is, and the jobs argument is, what will allow us to move forward.
Just one more comment on that. I think the big cop-out that a lot of people make is they say, okay, I may agree that we have a global climate issue, But it's not something that Oregon should be dealing with. This is a national issue, or this is an international issue. And so that becomes a good excuse to do nothing. And I think we've got to get beyond that. Other countries, other states have demonstrated a commitment to do it. And you have to understand that the United States and China are the two big contributors. And China is actually doing, in many respects, has much stronger environmental policies, although you couldn't tell it if you visit there, than the United States does. They're actually the world's leader in renewable energy production, both wind and solar. They're also one of the largest users of coal plants, and they're trying to address those problems. So it's not an easy issue to deal with. Oregon has done a pretty good job on the energy side. There's more that we can do and should do. The vehicle side we've not been as successful with, and that's the largest carbon polluter.
I'm Marilyn Milne. Our table was talking about how nice it is to hear that there was money to put toward programs, but a stable funding source that you could plan around and rely on would be ideal from session to session. So ideas included stabilization tax on timber as it comes out of the public woods. And the big thing is getting the repeal of the kicker back to the public to vote on. Is there a, particularly if you tied it to something like education funding, would there be political will? And what's the crystal ball say about the vote on that kind of, and overall, stable sources of funding is what we're after.
No, it's fine. I'm just going to be, characteristically honest. The polling is such that there is not the support to do anything with the personal kicker. It wouldn't pass. We could put it on the ballot. It would not pass. However, there are things that we can do, and one of the proposals that I was working with Representative Barnhart on and we're hopeful to bring forward for to go on the ballot is to change the kicker. Right now, you have to estimate what, how much or above or below what your economic forecast is every 2 years. Now, that's very, very difficult for as large of a budget as we have. If we could do that annually, one, when the kicker kicks, it wouldn't be so devastating. I mean, had we not had the revenue that came in, we could have ended up with $500 million that of a hole while we're sending money out to Oregonians. So if we were able to look at it just annually as opposed to every 2 years, I think that would allow us to have better aim. The closer you are to the target, the better you're able to aim. And also, we could minimize what the impact would be on our budget. So that's a way to address the issue without taking away something that Oregonians, even though we're the only state in the union that have it, that Oregonians feel pretty strongly that they're entitled to.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. You went on and on about not having enough money when, in fact, the wealthy, the corporate, the upper class are having an absolute boom in the last few years. Anyone looks at the charts and they see the money going right to the top. Years ago, we gave them tax breaks so that they would increase employment. And what they did was take that excess profit and send their jobs overseas so that they lied to us and left us in a terrible hole. Week by week, I watch people from the middle class still falling into poverty, and I see the number of homeless people overwhelming the charitable organizations that are trying to take care of the abandoned American. And so what I'm thinking is, how can we educate people to see a tax increase at the top isn't a general tax increase? They always sell it, this is a tax increase, as if the middle class and the working people are going to be hit harder, when in fact what we're asking for is to get rid of the tax breaks that went to the top.
Jerry, that's a tough one. That's an ongoing issue with that. A couple of points on that. One is Oregon's major taxing structure for state government is an income tax, and a lot of the deductions and things you're addressing, which I happen to agree with on a lot of it, is introduced through the federal system. And Oregon ties the starting place, the taxable income, to the federal system. So it's really hard for the state legislature to attack that one directly because of that, the tie to the federal system. It's part of the flaws, as Jay was talking about, of how we structure our support system. We're very, unlike most states, we're very dependent on two taxing sources, property taxes for local government and the income tax for state and schools. So that's a problem. In terms of getting changes in the legislature, one of the difficulties you'll recall is that in the 95, I believe it was, us as citizens voted to change the requirement to require a 3/5 vote of both houses of the legislature to change anything or to raise any revenue. That has made it impossible to get any revenue measures on the table and voted on. Just can't do it. Legislatively, you can't get there. The whatever party's out of power just kind of lays the blame on the other one. So you have that. But, you know, we have done some addressing in terms of Oregon's tax credits. Before I came back, the legislature did change the tax credits to a sunset process. So every tax credit gets reviewed, I believe it's every 6 years. And that's a way, unless they're renewed, then you don't have to take a 3/5 vote. In the current session, we had $60 million of tax credits that were up for renewal. The Ways and Means Chairs allotted $14 million. For that. So we have, over the last few sessions, been eliminating a lot of the tax credit programs. Good and bad. Depends on your perspective on whether it's good or not. But I think that's tough. I guess the last point I'd make is, while the legislature, I don't see us addressing that, although we have a task force that's looking at rebalancing the tax system. My personal position is we don't have just a problem with a fairer tax system. We have a tax system that's inadequate. Oregon continues to be, overall in terms of taxing, in the bottom quartile of taxing on citizens. So there's a reason we have problems funding schools and things like that. I believe that you will see from the Our Oregon group, which is a progressive group, you'll see a tax proposal put on the ballot that you'll vote on in 16, which will try to address some of this.
Okay. Thank you, Val Hoyle, Lee Bayer, and Jay Bozovich, for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club Program 2015 Legislative Wrap. It was a great session. And thanks again to our sponsors, Network Charter School, Marilyn Milne, and Dot Dotsons. We meet again on July 24th at the Downtown Athletic Club for 2015 NAACP's National Convention, Conversations Moving Forward in Our Communities, with guest speakers Eric Richardson and Dr. Edwin Coleman. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting our office. Thank you.